This is KOOP Hornsby Austin, 91.7, your community radio station. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio, in the spirit of the 60s Underground Press. That's sort of because that's where I came from, and so what I do is sort of informed by my experiences at that time. I was the original editor of The Rag, which was Austin's underground newspaper, and now we publish something called The Rag Blog. On December 23rd, 1991, a home fire killed Todd Cameron Willingham's three daughters. Willingham was later accused of starting the fire and convicted of murder and given a death sentence, based on forensic evidence and highly questionable testimony from a prison informant. He was executed on February 17, 2004, by lethal injection. Texas Governor Rick Perry refused to grant a stay despite a review by arson expert Dr. Craig Baylor, who was hired by the Texas Forensic Science Commission. His review shed serious doubt on the original findings of arson. Those findings, according to Baylor, were based on totally outdated junk science. Just before the commission was set to consider these findings, Perry ousted the chairman and three members of the panel. Todd Willingham is dead. Is Rick Perry guilty of obstruction of justice? On September 25, 2007, Sharon Keller, presiding judge on the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, blocked an appeal for death row inmate Michael Richards after his attorneys asked her to keep her office open for an extra 20 minutes so that they could file the papers. She refused, closing her doors at 5 o'clock sharp. Richards was executed. Judge Keller has been tried by the Commission on Judicial Conduct and faces the possibility of impeachment and possible removal from office. Michael Richards is dead. Should Sharon Keller be impeached? These cases have brought new national attention and scorn upon the Texas criminal justice system, upon its extensive use of the death penalty, and upon its governor. Texas has accounted for more than one-third of all modern executions, 1976 to the present, in the United States, with 441 executions to date. There are more than 340 inmates on Texas death row. In 2007, 42 inmates were executed in the United States, 26 of them in Texas. Yesterday, R.G. Ratcliffe reported in the Houston Chronicle that former Texas Governor and Attorney General Mark White, who was involved in the executions of 20 condemned criminals, and I'm quoting Ratcliffe here, White says that it may be time for Texas to do away with the death penalty. The death penalty is no longer a deterrent to murder, and long stays for the condemned on death row show justice is not swift, White said. More than anything, he said, he has grown concerned that the system is not administered fairly and that there are too many risks of executing innocent people. White cited both of the cases that I've just mentioned. Today on Rag Radio, we are discussing the death penalty and the role of politics in the Texas criminal justice system. My guests are Glenn W. Smith and Steve Hall. And Scott Cobb of the Texas Moratorium Network will join us later to discuss the 10th annual March to Abolish the Death Penalty set for Austin on October 24th. Glenn Smith and Steve Hall are both have extensive backgrounds in journalism and politics. Glenn ran Ann Richards' campaign for governor of Texas. According to Daily Kos founder Marcos Melitzis, Glenn Smith is, quote, a legendary political consultant and all-around good guy. His terrific new blog is called Dog Canyon. Check it out. Steve Hall served as chief of staff to the Attorney General of Texas from 1983 to 1991. He is director of the Stand Down Texas Project, which does criminal justice policy analysis and advocates a moratorium on executions in Texas and a review of the use of capital punishment in Texas. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome, Thorne.
Is Rick Perry going to face charges of obstruction of justice? What are the chances of that?
Well, that's a very good question, Thorne. I think that this is going to play out in the court of public opinion. Of course, the Republican primary is coming up in March 2010. You're already seeing the political implications of this with Kay Bailey Hutchison and Deborah Medina sniping at Governor Perry over his obstructionism. So we get a ringside seat to watch this play out.
Give us an overview of the whole situation with Todd Willingham. It's a remarkable situation.
You laid out the basic facts quite well. The December 1991 fire, his February 17th, 2004 execution. He said, "I am an innocent man convicted of a crime I did not commit. I have been persecuted for 12 years for something I did not do."
Of course, he's not the first person to be executed who's claimed innocence.
That's absolutely correct, and he's probably not the first innocent executed, even in Texas. The case really started to turn shortly before that execution, when his attorney, Skip Reeves of Waco, contacted a noted arson expert here in Austin, Gerald Hurst. Hurst examined the files, looked at all the information concerning the fire that had been entered into evidence in the trial, and came to the conclusion that there was no factual basis for a determination of arson. Mr. Reeves and Mr. Hurst took that to the governor, took it to the Board of Pardons and Paroles. The governor gave some small amount of consideration to that on the day of the execution, chose not to act, chose not to do the one thing that he could have done, which was issued a reprieve to examine the information more closely. The Board of Pardons and Paroles chose not to recommend a reprieve or recommend commutation or even to hold a hearing to examine the facts. Mr. Willingham was executed, but less than a year later, towards the end of 2004, Steve Mills and Maurice Posley, two investigative journalists with the Chicago Tribune, wrote about the Willingham case and brought this to the public light, really, for the first time. There was outrage from that. It led the Innocence Project to commission another noted arson expert, fire scientist, to look at the case. John Lentini also looked at it and determined no scientific basis for arson. That led, in part, to the creation of the Texas Forensic Science Commission in 2005 by the Texas legislature, that to look at this case, to look at problems from the Houston Police Department crime lab scandal.
What a scandal that's been.
That's right. And that commission was funded in 2007. So we move forward to the present. That commission had just started to really be able to take action. It had commissioned yet another arson expert, Craig Baylor, to examine this, and he issued a scathing report. Again, no determination of arson. Most likely, this was simply a fire of unknown origin, but no evidence of arson. And the commission was due to hold a hearing on October 2nd. Mr. Baylor was going to be there, and the commission was going to determine how to move forward from there when suddenly Governor Perry sacked several members of the commission. The new chairman, John Bradley, the district attorney of Williamson County, postponed the meeting, and there we stand. The next event will be on November the 10th when Senator John Whitmire's Criminal Justice Committee of the Texas Senate talks with Mr. Bradley in hearing to see what his plans are.
Question. Was the problem with the original arson investigation the fact that the science has changed since then, or were they just especially inept?
There are two factors that sit on top of each other. First, arson investigators, fire marshals, tend to get a lot of in-the-field training. They tend to have strong mentors. They learn this by doing. They typically are not trained scientists. That's not the case, for instance, with a DNA technician. And the second part of that is that, yes, the science had changed dramatically. And it had changed dramatically right about the time of the Willingham family fire. What happened was there had been wildfires in Oakland, California in the late 80s. And the insurance adjusters who went to resolve those insurance claims were quite surprised to find signs that they had always taken to be indicators of arson existent in all of these house fires. And yet, they knew it wasn't arson. They knew it was a naturally occurring wildfire. So that led the scientist to then completely revise the scientific basis for arson investigations.
And so there was really no Pentagon burned into the floor.
No, there wasn't.
Okay, Glenn Smith, you on Dog Canyon, your new blog, which I believe just officially launched last week, you've done some pretty substantial investigation, pretty substantial reporting on this issue. Where does it stand now? What have you found out? What have you been writing about?
Well, first, the action of Governor Perry to fire all of his appointees to the Forensic Science Commission was an extraordinary. He called it business as usual, having either covered
for him in some ways it is
having either covered or worked in state government for longer than I want to tell you. I'll tell you that's not business as usual. If you want to put it in some mundane perspective, think about the Public Utility Commission is getting ready to lower electric rates, and he fires them before they can do that. And that's basically what he did here was obstruct a public hearing at this committee or commission right on the eve of its action. That's an extraordinary step for a governor to take. I think he thought that he could get away with a one-day story.
Has this taken him by surprise?
I think it's taken him a little by surprise that it created the furor that it has. I'm proud to say that we've been able to, the Dog Canyon's been able to advance the story a bit on its own. And one of the first things we looked at were the grants to Texas law enforcement that flow to district attorneys and crime labs and police departments to do forensic science. And the commission itself was set up to oversee that. In fact, it was a requirement to receive the money. This was money for law enforcement. Not to get people off, but for law enforcement to pursue investigations. And it turns out that by so sullying the state committee, Perry might have blocked some of that money that would be, he'd look at it as anti-crime money. He might be the worst enemy of police departments and district attorneys at the moment because of that action. Another thing we looked at was the unequal justice and the sheer hypocrisy that his general counsel at the time of
you
the
mean there was an arsonist investigating an arsonist?
It appears that might be the case. His general counsel at the time of the Willingham execution was a man named David Medina, who he subsequently appointed to the Texas Supreme Court. Medina was then in charge of reviewing the case as it came from pardons and paroles to Perry for a stay of execution. The fact that it doesn't appear that they even considered an independent forensic scientist report is rather damning when you skip a little forward in time and realize that David Medina and his wife Francisca were both indicted in a fire that burned down their home, she for arson, he for suppression of evidence. She ultimately got off and got the indictment dismissed just last August based on, guess what, an independent forensic scientist, fire experts report to the court.
Ah, sweet irony.
Yes, it is, isn't it? I haven't really revisited the Willingham case. It is the gross mismanagement of government by Perry, even in cases of life or death, that I have tried to focus on. And that's where I think the focus should be, and I do think there'll be political consequences for the governor.
Will there be legal consequences? One thing that you did discuss was the question of obstruction of justice, and you started building a case for that. How likely is that to happen?
Well, we looked at the law as it pertains to fulfilling the Justice Department guidelines for receiving the money and for the operations of the Forensic Science Commission itself. And they are very specific and refer to federal criminal statute if you violate these, especially if you mislead. So if you tell the Justice Department you're doing A and you do B, it's right in there that, oh, by the way, we're going to apply this criminal statute to your behavior. Now, will they pursue that? Will a U.S. attorney somewhere pursue that against Perry? I think it's not very likely, frankly. It's pretty much, it's a technicality. What's probably more likely to happen is a review of the Texas operations with regard to forensic science, period. That would be enough of a negative consequence. People should remember that the science isn't there simply to protect the innocent from prosecution. It's also there to pursue the guilty. So if we interrupt that, there's no Texan that'll be in favor for it.
Consequences. Consequences for Rick Perry. Consequences for the Texas criminal justice system. We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and we're talking with Glenn Smith and Steve Hall. Right now, we're going to take a quick break.
Sitting here on death row, behind a ton of steel. And they say before I die, I got to eat my last meal.
Rag Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer with Glenn Smith and Steve Hall. Consequences. What is this going to mean for Rick Perry, politically and otherwise?
Let's start looking at that, at the context he finds himself in today. I think he was reelected with 39% of the vote last time. He is, I think embarrassingly, Texas's longest serving governor, but some special circumstances have afforded him that chance.
Honor, that special honor.
He became governor when George Bush moved on to the White House, et cetera, et cetera. So he's not very popular to start with. Texas faces enormous problems on a number of fronts, in public education, in higher education at its expense, and it being put out of the reach of many Texans. Our roads, our water supply for the future, our environment, the job and economy, all these things are worrying Texans today. So he starts at a disadvantage, and I think voters have a very, very open mind, we might say, to the criticism of Perry. Then we come along to this case, which, as we said before, is a matter of life or death. It's not just an invisible bureaucratic thing happening in the background somewhere. A man died in this instance because of the mismanagement and the sort of cavalier disregard for life that we saw out of Perry's office. I think that amplifies the negatives on Governor Perry and makes him vulnerable to attack on this issue, even though, if you look at the polls, there's substantial support for capital punishment in Texas when the question simply put to voters. Most of those, however, who say they support it assume that it is only applied in cases of absolute certainty after very vigorous review by the courts, by the Board of Pardons and Paroles, and by the governor.
Isn't that the way it works?
I'm afraid that's not the way it works. I think that's another thing that plays against a judgment against, or plays for a judgment against Perry, because he's sort of interrupted or violated a rationalization and a narrative that the public wants to believe, you know, that people are executed only when we're absolutely certain that they're guilty of the crime for which they were sentenced to death. And he's raised the question by his actions, very precipitous actions, firing his board members, for instance, before a hearing, et cetera. He's raised the question about whether Texas might be a lot more cavalier about its application of the death penalty than most Texans would prefer.
We'll get back. We want to talk about 2010 in a minute, too. But, Steve, what about, speaking of cavalier, what effect do you think that Sharon Keller's actions had? It also received a lot of national attention when she what do you think?
Well, frankly, it's another embarrassment. It's another black eye on criminal justice in Texas. And you take that, you take the sleeping lawyer, you take another version of The Sleeping Lawyer, of Charles Dean Hood's prosecutor and trial judge, who were having a romantic affair during his capital murder trial. You take,
which didn't turn out to be basis for a new trial, did it?
That not from the court, not from this court of criminal appeals. You look at these incidences, and you know, even another judge on the court of criminal appeals, Judge Tom Price, said that Sharon Keller's actions made that court a laughingstock. And they expose Texas to some of the worst forms of criminal justice, truly reckless disregard for getting it right.
And there's been a lot of attention. There's been a lot of national publicity. The Willingham case just drew a major feature in The New Yorker. It's been all over the place, newspapers all over. And it seems like Texas and Governor Perry's actions in other regards also have brought ridicule upon the state. The question is that having any, are people in Texas starting to think, well, you know, maybe we don't like being seen in this light? Or people proud of it?
Let's contrast the actions of Governor Perry and Judge Keller with another Texas elected official, Craig Watkins, the Dallas County District Attorney. When it became apparent that people in Dallas had been wrongfully convicted and could be exonerated by DNA evidence, Craig Watkins embraced that. He worked cooperatively with the Innocence Project to review questionable cases. Dallas County, fortunately, had stored evidence properly, so that DNA evidence was available for testing years after the fact. Well, what we've seen is that Dallas County leads the nation in DNA exonerations, and Craig Watkins has stood up for Texas justice, for getting it right, and for comforting the victims of crime.
Does the fact that they lead in exonerations suggest that they're doing it right now, or does it also suggest that they didn't do it right in the original case, in the courts?
There are plenty of bad incidents from the past in Dallas County prosecutions that show that prosecutors were more concerned with convictions than with justice.
In Harris County, on the other hand, which is not known for its enlightened criminal justice system, they didn't get it right, did they?
They didn't get it right.
They haven't gotten it right.
They didn't get it right on two different fronts. Once again, you had a regime that was interested in convictions over justice, but even worse, they didn't store the evidence properly. And one death penalty case that we haven't talked about today, the case of Francis Newton, in which Governor Perry did issue a reprieve to allow for some forensic testing. Well, that was all for naught because Harris County had not stored the evidence properly. It was completely contaminated and could not be tested. As a result, Frances Newton, another person who went to her death proclaiming her innocence, was killed by the state of Texas.
How much of course, there's a lot of things that affect the justice system in this state, and I guess some of them are general throughout the country. But one thing, as you mentioned, is the tendency of prosecution to want, in the pressure on prosecutors to get convictions at whatever expense. Another thing is we were even discussing the plea bargaining, the fact that people, because of fear of consequences, because of fear of what a jury is going to do to them, because of threats that are made to them, the way people will cop out to stuff that they're not guilty to, it seems like there's a number of areas in which we need to work to change things.
Yeah, and if I could say what moderate Texans I think are waking up to the fact that when a criminal justice system breaks down, in this case, it's broken down in several jurisdictions in Texas and perhaps even statewide because there's an overzealous cavalier prosecutions as we've been discussing, and bad science. But when the system breaks down, it's the security of our neighborhoods that are really put in jeopardy. I mean, the criminal justice system depends on getting it right. It's the question on the table really isn't, are we tough on crime or are we not tough on crime? The problem
is, are we tough on the right criminal?
We have to be. We have to get it right. The whole system depends on that. Now, mistakes are going to happen because we're human beings. That's all the more reason to be as right as we possibly can be in the investigation and the pursuit of the lowliest crimes to the most heinous crimes, in making sure that only the guilty go to prison or certainly face execution. I think it's often lost in the debate that tough on the so-called tough on crime Texans are ultimately the ones who are going to be disappointed by a broken down system.
And perhaps even become victims of future crime. It seems like what people want to do is they want to put, they, I mean, the, since there's a lot of insecurity, there's a lot of fear right now in this country, and especially in this state, and that's certainly fed by the right-wing politicians, what that leads to, I think, is quite frequently is support for this kind of really kind of not very thoughtful prosecution, people don't realize that what happens is that if you decide that you put somebody away, if that person isn't guilty, that the person who did perpetrate the crime is still out there on the streets.
It's very easy for a citizen to think about that in the abstract, isn't it, really?
Yes.
And so let's personalize it. And I can imagine that if somebody attacked a loved one of mine, I could become quite, let's say, strong in my response to it. But how would I feel if I went out and hurt the wrong person in reprisal? How would I feel personally if I grabbed an innocent person and punished them for something someone else did? But I'm not talking about an abstract that happens far away from me in the dark of night in the Texas prison system. I'm talking about it in terms of my own hands. I'd feel terrible. And it's one of the reasons we create systems of justice so we don't individually face that situation. And so we all agree that we're going to put a system in place to take care of these issues for us so we don't wind up being eye for an eye people personally engaged in acts of reprisals on those we believe have harmed us. I think Texans are waking up to that. I think cases like this Willingham case are making it apparent that we better all take a little bit more responsibility for what's going on in the criminal justice system.
I think a lot of bad justice is driven by a misdirected sense of this concept of closure. The other thing that I think happens is that there's a feeling that if somebody has been convicted, that even if they aren't guilty, especially of, you know, a capital crime, they're probably bad actors anyway, and they probably deserve it.
Excuse me, Steve, but I've got to respond to that. I believe in Western jurisprudence that criminal justice systems were created to avoid precisely that. Governor Perry said something similar when he said Willingham's a bad man.
A monster.
Then it was sort of what he was saying was, regardless of the facts in the case, he's a bad man that probably deserved the punishment he got. Well, I submit that what we've tried to do in the West for 1,500 or more years is eliminate the use of that word regardless, right, is to get it right and not base our judgments on subjective essentializing or characterization of other people who we then say can be punished simply because we deem them bad, not because of anything we've proved they've done, but simply because they're not like us.
But you think the tide may be turning a bit? Do you think that all of this publicity is helping to maybe change people's minds, change people's attitudes?
Well, it's certainly been driving
changes. And it's changes. Plus the stuff that's been in the press.
Yes. Even before the Willingham case revealed itself, we saw a major shift in Texas through the Scripps-Howard Texas poll. We saw a swift change in public opinion as to executing innocent people. By the end of the Texas poll in 2004, 70% of the Texans surveyed believed that this state had executed innocent people Now, that's because of a number of significant cases that were raised by journalists, by reporters, by advocates. And that played out in different ways. One of the things people demanded was an available sentence of life without parole as an alternative to death sentences. The legislature passed that in 2005, and subsequently we have seen a reduction in the number of death sentences, mirroring what we're seeing nationwide. Fewer death sentences, fewer people being sentenced to death, and we're seeing other changes. We have seen the passage of the Texas Fair Defense Act, which for the first time put state money into our indigent defense system that is largely paid for by county government. We've seen standards for attorneys. We've seen the State Bar of Texas get active in promoting and advancing measures for attorney performance in capital cases. So we're seeing substantial changes in the criminal justice system in large measure because people are waking up to the problems.
Okay. What does this all tell us about Rick Perry, about the way he governs? This is not really anomalous, is it? Doesn't this kind of fit in with his entire pattern?
Well, you know, Thorne, one of the interesting things is that every legislative session that Rick Perry has been involved with as governor has been dramatically different. They've had completely different personalities, really as if they were driven more by the chief of staff than by the governor. And that's quite unusual because Rick Perry was a state legislator. He was a statewide office holder before he became governor. Immediately before he became governor, he was the lieutenant governor and acted as the president of the Texas Senate. So that vacancy and that change, that different persona with every session, I think is quite unusual.
If I get to listing the faults of Governor Rick Perry, you're going to run out of time for the show, so I better kind of limit what I say about it. And his style of government, I think, appears to be distract on this side while I loot the state treasury for my friends over here. And that's about all he really focuses on. If you look at any area of policy, a majority of Texans really do care about. So public education, highest dropout rate in the nation, number of insured citizens, highest number of uninsured citizens in the country or in Texas, lack of access to health care for children, largest number of children without access to health care in the country, highways deteriorating because he bet on the ability to let a foreign company build toll roads, in some cases turn existing roads into toll roads and operate them as a private road, and it failed, and now we're stuck without enough roads, period, and the ones we do have are deteriorating. Water crisis is right on the horizon. We're in a drought. We all know it. Not been dealt with. The environment is but one of the worst in the countries in terms of both air and water. In all these areas, Governor Perry has failed for several years now, which is why his missteps in a matter like the Willingham case take on a very exaggerated importance. If he had been a popular governor who had handled all these problems for the people of Texas over the course of his tenure, it might be a different story, but it's not a different story. And I think Texans have run out of patience with both his style and the substance or lack of substance of his governing.
This is Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guests today are Glenn Smith and Steve Hall. And in a few minutes, we're going to be bringing Scott Cobb into it to discuss maybe what some of us can, a little something we can do to try to at least express our opinions about what's going on. Okay, this is Thorne Dreyer, Rag Radio. We're talking with Glenn Smith and Steve Hall, and we're going to bring Scott Cobb in just a second. Before we do that, though, what about 2010? What's going to happen? How does Rick Perry stand?
Well, as Glenn pointed out, he is a minority governor. He won election last time with 39% of the vote. You've got a situation right now where Kay Bailey Hutchison, according to the latest polling, seems to be up in the polls over Perry. You've got Perry being criticized on this issue, on the Willingham issue, from Senator Hutchison and from the other person in the race, Deborah Medina, a county official who is more of a teabagger, libertarian. And so it looks like we are going to be seeing a very robust primary election season that, Glenn, frankly, it seems to have already started.
I think so, too. I think we're already deep into the cycle, actually. One thing to keep in mind is I think that Congress is going to pass health care reform, and I think the political landscape is going to change in ways it's hard to envision now. But all things being equal, I think it's fair to say that the string is kind of run out on this extreme right-wing form of government that the Republicans have pursued for some time, which is invest nothing in our children, invest nothing in our infrastructure, somehow depend on the problems like this to be solved magically, and it's failed. And I think Texans have awakened to that fact that the rhetoric of the right sounds good, but it's failed. It's failed Texans on every single front. And we can't keep proceeding this way. We can't survive as a state. We become something like a third world country. And I know it's a fact that there are many in Republican leadership circles that are people with integrity who, of all the things they're doing, are calling me a pretty well-known Democratic activist and consultant, looking for ways out of the bind they've got themselves into. And if they're willing to call a guy like me, I would imagine that they're looking for ways behind the scenes to get rid of a guy like Perry.
So praise the Lord, the tide may be turning.
It's quite possible.
Is there any chance we'll have a Democrat for a governor?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if we had universal voting in Texas, if everybody went to the polls, we'd be about a 10 or 12% Democratic state, which is why, by the way, the Republicans invest so much time and effort and energy and voter suppression techniques to keep everybody from voting, because if everybody did, they'd lose, and they know it. What we need to do is energize the voters, make them aware of the issues and aware of what they can do about it. Getting them to act, I think you're going to get to something about that in just a moment, is a critical first step in getting people politically engaged. I really think the chances are pretty good in 2010.
On Saturday, October 24th, Todd Willingham's mother is leading the 10th annual march to abolish the death penalty here in Austin. Scott Cobb is president of the Texas Moratorium Network. Scott, and I want everybody to still join in, but Scott, tell us both what's happening at that march and also what the Texas Moratorium Network is.
Well, the March to Abolish the Death Penalty, this is the 10th year of the march. We first got started back in 2000. If you remember back then, the governor of Illinois instituted a moratorium on executions there, which is still in place. There hasn't been any executions since then in Illinois. And we had the idea that we should have a moratorium on executions here in Texas, and we wanted to start advocating for that. So in 2000, we organized the first march, and subsequently to that, we went down to the legislature and gave them the opportunity to pass a moratorium, which they chose not to do, although in 2001, it did pass two committees in the House and in the Senate. That was back when the Democrats were in control of those committees and more in control of the legislature. And of course, they have failed to do it. And we've continued on every year since then to have a march against the death penalty, calling for a moratorium on executions over the years. This year, we changed it to the March to Abolish the Death Penalty in order to make it clear that there are people in Texas who are concerned about the fact that we have executed innocent people and who feel like we should end the death penalty. And I think that opinion is spreading more and more towards the general public and towards people who in the past have supported the death penalty. You've already spoken about former Governor Mark White. His opinion has been evolving, and I think that has happened a lot over the last 10 years for the people who have seen the march every year. So,
And if not, if people's, I think what Glenn was saying before is that the polling has shown, there maybe suggests that the support is softening, and it has a lot to do with how questions are asked. Tell us about what the event's going to be like. What is that?
Well, at 2 o'clock, we're going to be down at the Texas Capitol. So if you're in Austin, go down to the Capitol, and we're going to be meeting around the gates that go into the Capitol near the sidewalk there on 11th Street in Congress. That's the initial gathering point at 2 o'clock, and we'll have a couple of speakers, and then we'll march down Congress Avenue, come back to the Capitol around 2:30, go up to the south steps at the very entrance of the Capitol, and have some more speakers. And I think it's an opportunity not only for people to express their outrage at what happened to Todd Willingham, but also to get a little bit more informed about the issues, because we will have people there who have been innocent and sent to death row. We have this gentleman coming down from Oklahoma who spent 19 years on death row in Oklahoma until he was exonerated, Curtis McCarty. And he was finally exonerated in part because of DNA testing, which is not always available. It luckily was in his case. And so after 19 years on death row and another 2 years in prison, he was released just in 2007. We have a couple of other exonerated people coming down to the march also. So it's important to see these people in person, because a lot of people will argue, well, the fact that we may execute an innocent person is just the cost of having a death penalty. I've actually heard people say that in the last few weeks with the Willingham issue.
You think they're less likely to say that if they actually see the person in flesh and blood?
Right. If you see the person
this
standing there.
This is a human being.
This is not a name on a piece of paper. This is not some vague concept in your head about, the cost of the death penalty is an occasional innocent person. This is a live human being with family, with loved ones, who's standing there in front of you. And I guarantee you there will be tears at the march. I mean, whenever I talk about it, it just gets very emotional. So, I mean, if you come to the march, you can expect a very emotional time, but you'll also have a lot of reward that you're coming out and speaking out on a very important issue at a time in Texas when we can make a change. Because I think in the next legislature, the moratorium issue is going to advance further than it ever has, and we could actually have a moratorium passed in 2011.
Do you gentlemen have any other ideas of things people can do? How can we have an effect? How can our listeners, how can people out there in the population who find this to be outrageous, what can they do?
Well, I think a first step that everybody can undertake inside themselves is to examine their own role in the creation or the destruction of a criminal justice system may have once worked well. In the case of capital punishment, I think it would help people if they would just pause a moment and understand that the state is performing these executions in their name, as citizens of the state of Texas, not in somebody else's name, not in the names of the people in Oklahoma or New Mexico or Arkansas, but in the names of the citizens of Texas. We bear a personal responsibility for how such things are carried out. We can't duck it. If we stop and think about it, we can't pretend that's going on without my agreement. It is going on with our agreement.
Can we also say that perhaps because of what we've talked about in terms of maybe some new tide of change in Texas politics, that those who have been frustrated and probably haven't worked within the political system, haven't really gotten energized to get out there, that maybe that's the other thing we can do, that now maybe if people feel that there's a chance to have an effect. And I know in the last election cycle, a lot of things changed on a lot of levels in Texas. And I think they're going to change more the next time. I mean, you know, in Dallas and Houston, for instance, dramatic changes. Do we actually feel at this point that we're overcome that tide of the effect of the redistricting that so froze things in place in a lot of ways?
Thorne, you hit a great point there, that in some ways the tide has already changed. We're seeing that in Dallas County. We're seeing it in Harris County. So we are seeing a greater awareness. And I'd say, first, get involved. Go to Dog Canyon. Go to standdown.org. Go to the news sources. But then, once you're informed, reach out to your elected officials. Everyone in Texas has a state representative and a state senator. And I think everyone has a responsibility to meet that person, to meet the individuals who represent you, who vote for you in the Texas legislature, who pass the laws, and to inform them, to help better guide them how to run this state.
Thorne, I just wanted to mention again, bring in another person who's going to be at the march on Saturday. We often get the question, well, what would you do if it was a member of your own family who was murdered, and how would you react? And one of the people coming to the march is a mother, Jeanette Popp, whose daughter was murdered here in Austin back in 1988, and two people were wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death, I mean, not to death, excuse me, to life in prison, and spent 12 years in prison before they were exonerated. But she is against the death penalty, and she has spoken out against it. She's pressured the DA here in Travis County not to seek the death penalty. And I was with her the day that she met and sat across the table from the person who killed her daughter and said, I want to save your life, because it isn't something that my daughter would want, that you would be killed. And so she will be there on Saturday, and that's an opportunity for people to come meet her. Also, on Friday at 7 p.m., we're going to have a panel discussion at the University of Texas in the Texas Union Building with two of the exonerated people, Curtis McCarty, who I've already spoken about, and Shuja Graham, who also spent 3 years on death row, and Liz Gilbert, who was the pen pal of Todd Willingham, and she was the first person who first investigated whether or not he was innocent. At first, she didn't believe what he was saying, but then she actually did some investigating on her own, met with various people, including the Willingham family, interviewed them herself, and really brought the attention, the case to the attention of the lawyers and the family in a way that it was further investigated. And so she was a very key player in this whole issue with Todd Willingham. So she will be there on Friday at 7. It's a Texas Union Building in the Sinclair Suite.
Great. That's Scott Cobb. One thing we should point out too is that I don't care whether they get exonerated or not. Anybody who's spent time on death row, especially, and in fact in
TDCJ,
Texas Criminal Justice, Texas Department of Criminal Justice, you never get that time back. You never make that up. That's always with you. That has lasting impact.
And Thorne, thanks to the leadership of Senator Rodney Ellis of Houston and others in the legislature, that is one thing that Texas is leading on. Senator Ellis got the compensation for those wrongfully convicted increased from a cap of $25,000 up to $50,000 per year of wrongful incarceration. And in the last session, there was some other legislation that increased that again to $80,000 per year, and also some options for doing that through annuities, for some other educational and counseling opportunities. So there are people in this government concerned with getting it right.
And I'd like to go back and answer your question about how and why people should get involved and use a couple of examples. First thing I'd like people to remember is that the production of hopelessness is the first strategy of oppressors. Look at the number of heroes in the 20th century, from Martin Luther King to Nelson Mandela to Gandhi, who refused to be hopeless. Now consider yourself a poor to middle class Texan today who's just anxious for their children's health and their inability to get them health care, or who can't find a job, or who are forced to work four jobs in order to take care of their kids. They would like something done about it. But everywhere they look, it looks like they can't succeed. They can't change a political system that's all but enforcing their dire circumstances. But the truth is, we're on the eve of profound changes in Texas. The only missing ingredient now is the hopefulness of the voter. So I encourage people to see that there is light at the end of the tunnel, that the sun is coming up, and all we need now is to make it happen. Change is certain. Change is going to happen, and it's in our hands to make it the right kind of change.
Oh, and there was one other issue I wanted to bring about on the Saturday. Another issue of that's related to the death penalty is the law of parties. That is when someone can be convicted and sentenced to death even though they themselves did not kill anyone. If you remember back in 2007, Rick Perry commuted the death sentence of Kenneth Foster, who had been convicted of and sentenced to death because he was the driver of a car out of which somebody got out without his knowledge of what he was going to do and ended up killing someone. And this, in the past session of the legislature, the Texas House actually passed a bill that would have banned the death penalty for people who don't kill anyone but are convicted under the law of parties. And at the march on Saturday, we'll have representatives of family members who are on death row, their loved ones on death row, under that law of parties. The Jeff Wood is on death row. He had got a commutation just last year, but he's still there. His family will be here on Saturday speaking out, trying to build support so that the next legislature can pass a bill to ban executions of people who don't actually kill anyone.
Okay, what other signs of hope are there that we can grab a hold of in the Texas criminal justice system and in Texas politics?
Well, you're seeing a reassessment of a host of criminal justice issues, not just in Texas, but nationally, including this over-incarceration of citizens. Glenn and I were talking just the other day about in our days in government when Glenn was a bureau chief, and the Texas prison system had 35,000 inmates. Today it has more than that in guards and employees, 155,000 inmates incarcerated, locked down in prison tonight. We're seeing a real reassessment of that. Senator Whitmire talks about not just getting tough on crime, but getting smart on crime with lots of programming to change what we've seen over the past few years.
But one of the problems is, it seems to me, is that there's always been enlightened views of better ways to deal with crime and punishment, but that so much is controlled not just by, you know, good intentions, but by money, by corporate involvement, by institutions that are staid in their ways, by patterns, by momentum, and that there's always a lot of money involved in maintaining the status quo.
And I think people probably said that right before women got the right to vote, that it's always been they couldn't vote. And why should we work hard to get them to vote? And suddenly, people did work hard enough and they got the vote. I think the same is true about emancipation. I think the same is true about the great programs of Franklin Roosevelt, that just on their eve, people were at risk of their greatest lack of hope. Thorne. But they managed the hope, and it comes true.
Well, one thing, what's happening in the healthcare in the situation with healthcare reform is that not very long ago, I think most of us who believe in serious healthcare reform, not just cosmetic healthcare reform and not just insurance reform, had almost given up hope because it seemed like the insurance companies were so much in control that there was so much money at play, that so many politicians appeared to be bought off. And then the insurance company has kind of overplayed its hand in the insurance industry, and all of a sudden, that despite that power that they've had, it seems like there's a real chance now for serious change.
Citizen
engagement, citizen involvement. People can go to get more information about the march on Saturday to www.marchforabolition.org, and about Cameron Todd Willingham, we have a special website with a lot of links to the original New Yorker article and the report by Dr. Baylor, www.CameronToddWillingham.com, and people can also sign a petition there that we'll be turning in on Saturday.
Well, that's what I was going to do about now, is just ask for everybody to say how they can get in touch with You know, what? Give us addresses for your websites. Tell us how to find Dog Canyon.
It's very simple. Dogcanyon.org. Dogcanyon.org. Love to have you come by the canyon.
Dogcanyon.org.
And standdown.org, standdown.org.
Okay, and I would also like to mention now, because we're kind of running down to, this has gone fast. This has been very, I think, enjoyable, very interesting discussion. That next week on RAG Radio, we're going to discuss transportation policy, growth, and the environment with transportation activists Roger Baker and Dick Callerman. And Roger Baker is a regular contributor to the RAG blog, which brings us full circle here. The RAG blog is at and the RAG blog is an internet news magazine that's based in Austin but has an international audience. It's at theragblog.blogspot.com. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and my guests today have been Glenn Smith, Steve Hall, and Scott Cobb. And I hope we've all learned something and have some ideas about things that we can do to change what's happening. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio.
Sleeping back.